KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. A number of judges are exasperated with the Trump administration, saying they're not obeying their orders. Are the administration's lawyers stonewalling or just representing their client? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. At first, Pope Francis defended Chilean clergy who were accused of letting abuse happen. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. He later apologized and formed a years-long friendship with a victim of that abuse. Also, we hear from Beyonce and Solange's mom, Tina Knowles, about being the matriarch of their famous family and what came before. It is Friday, April 25th. On this day in 1901, New York required drivers to show their initials on the backs of their cars, the first state to require license plates. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. There are conflicting statements from President Trump and Chinese officials about whether they've been in trade talks. Trump says he has, but won't clarify how recently those talks happened. China has been insisting that any report of current U.S.-Chinese trade talks is false. Top Chinese leaders met today in Beijing and pledged a string of new measures to boost their economy. NPR's John Ruich reports it's been complicated by high U.S. tariffs.
An official readout of the meeting of the Communist Party's elite Politburo said external shocks to the economy are increasing, and it's necessary to prepare contingency plans. For companies significantly affected by tariffs, the Politburo said more funds should be allocated to help with retention. The meeting called for the prompt implementation of more proactive and effective macroeconomic policies. It urged local governments to issue special bonds to support basic living expenses and salaries. It called for steps to boost pay for low and middle income groups and said there should be more done to help struggling companies and boost core tech industries. The Politburo also called for steps to boost domestic consumption. That's something that many economists have been urging and something likely to help cushion the blow from tariffs. John Ruich, NPR News, Shanghai.
President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, is in Moscow meeting Russian President Vladimir Putin. Trump says the U.S. is trying to get support for its plan to end Russia's war in Ukraine. He wants Ukraine to give up territory to Russia to bring this about. In an interview published today by Time magazine, Trump said that the annexed Ukrainian region of Crimea will stay with Russia. That's been a non-starter for the Ukrainian government. Ukraine is observing a day of mourning today for the 12 people killed this week by a Russian attack on the capital, Kyiv. Trump had rebuked Russia's president, writing online, quote, "Vladimir, stop." A federal judge is blocking the president's executive order on voting, saying President Trump lacks the authority to make the change. As NPR's Jude Joffe Block reports, the provision would require someone to provide proof of citizenship to register to vote in the U.S.
A federal judge paused that provision, writing, quote, "Our Constitution entrusts Congress and the states, not the president, with the authority to regulate federal elections." The judge's ruling is a victory for voter registration groups and Democrats who say such a requirement could create barriers for millions of eligible voters. In a statement, White House spokesperson Harrison Fields said the president will keep fighting for election integrity. Jude Joffe Block, NPR News.
Texas lawmakers have passed legislation to create an enormous school voucher program. The $1 billion plan will let parents use taxpayer money to pay for tuition at private schools for children. Opponents of vouchers say this will drain money away from public schools and hurt children from low-income families. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 200 points. This is NPR. World leaders, including President Trump, are traveling to Rome to attend tomorrow's funeral for Pope Francis. Some conservative American Catholics are expressing their hopes for a new pontiff. They're also criticizing Pope Francis. They claim he abandoned important aspects of Catholic tradition. Aleha Herzer-McCain of Religion News Service has more.
Conservatives are revisiting Francis' policies that they disagreed with. Those include his suppression of certain Latin masses, allowing the blessing of same-sex couples, and his advocacy for the environment and thawing of relations with China. New York Cardinal Timothy Dolan told the Today Show he's looking for the next pope to have a blend of the heart of Francis, but also some qualities he liked in Pope John Paul II and Benedict XVI.
More clarity in teaching, more refinement of the church's tradition, more digging in the treasures of the past.
According to a poll taken in February, most Republican-leaning Catholics in the U.S. supported Pope Francis, and Vatican watchers warn against trying to reduce any pope into U.S. political terms. Aleja Hertzler-McCain, NPR News.
The man accused of killing UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson last year will appear in federal court today in New York to enter a plea. Luigi Mangione was indicted last week on murder and other charges. Federal prosecutors say they'll seek the death penalty. Today is World Malaria Day. The World Health Organization says that since the 90s, more than 2 billion cases have been prevented worldwide. But the WHO says malaria still kills one person every minute. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. In a few minutes, we'll take a look at why the housing market is moving at a snail's pace.
First, President Trump is working hard to implement a campaign promise for mass deportations.
Officials are moving quickly to arrest, detain, and remove people from the country. But critics say such fast action skirts due process that all people in the U.S. should receive.
NPR's immigration policy reporter Jimena Bustillo joins us now to unpack all of this. So, Jimena, has the administration addressed what due process means for their mass deportation goals?
Yes. Earlier this week, Trump said that it wasn't possible for all the people he wants to remove to get a trial.
And I hope we get cooperation from the courts because, you know, we have thousands of people that are ready to go out. And you can't have a trial for all of these people.
Vice President J.D. Vance went as far as to call it a, quote, fake legal process on social media. And in another post, Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller has said, quote, the judicial process is for Americans. Immediate deportation is for illegal aliens. But critics broadly point to the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. That states that no person can, quote, be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The administration seems to be banking on Americans believing that non-citizens don't get the same due process as citizens. That's according to Muzaffar Chishti from the Migration Policy Institute.
That may be politically a good slogan. Unfortunately, the Constitution does not make any distinction between citizens and non-citizens for the application of the protections of due process and judicial review.
The ultimate concern, he says, is that if you strip due process for one group, that's a slippery slope for others.
So let's get into that, because let's assume that some people are good with the argument that due process rights are not owed to everyone. What's the argument then about why that's not just incorrect, that it is a slippery slope for absolutely everyone?
You know, put simply, because mistakes are made. It's central to the Constitution that if the government makes any accusation, people accused have a chance to respond. Immigration courts were designed specifically as a neutral space where both the government and immigrants could both make their cases. Not every person gets the same rights, though. It's a spectrum of rights, you know, law experts tell me. It depends on how long you've been in the country and other factors. I spoke with Ashley Tabador. She's a former immigration judge, and she said the government can't just act on the basis of allegations.
Government is not immune from making errors, and errors that can cost someone's life. So what is at stake is oftentimes a life and death situation.
Now, are there any examples of such errors already?
You know, the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia brought the question of due process to the forefront. In 2019, an immigration judge had decided that he could not be deported to El Salvador, but last month officials arrested him. Within days and by mistake, he was sent to a prison in El Salvador. Other lawyers fighting Trump's policies have alleged their clients didn't have deportation orders yet and were due in court, and suddenly they ended up in other countries. And lawyers have told me that they've defended U.S. citizens or others with legal status who got arrested or detained when they shouldn't have. But Trump administration is making other changes too. They increased the number of people who can be removed without a court hearing, and they've terminated contracts that provide legal services to over 20,000 minors without legal status. And they fired and accepted resignations from over 100 court staff, including dozens of judges. Critics warn that erodes those due process protections America was founded on.
That's NPR's immigration policy reporter, Ximena Bustillo. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Critics argue that one way the administration is depriving people of due process is by evading court orders or producing inadequate information. And in fact, a handful of judges have been blasting the administration for this. So we're going to talk for a few more minutes about this with Elliot Williams. He was a deputy assistant attorney general under the Obama administration. Good morning, Elliot.
Good morning, Michelle.
U.S. District Judge Paula Cini said in an 8-page order this week that the Trump administration had, quote, sought refuge behind vague and unsubstantiated assertions of privilege, using them as a shield to obstruct discovery and evade compliance with this court's orders, unquote. Now, Elliot, judges are human and they get annoyed, especially when they think lawyers are sloppy or unprepared. But help me understand, how serious a scolding is this? Is she saying that the administration is doing this deliberately?
Oh, this is a quite serious scolding. Sure, Michelle, judges are human, but you can read between the lines and see when a judge has simply lost patience with a litigant. It happens all the time. I think even more telling is the fact that she put the government at one point in the trial on daily reminders, making them come in every single day with a filing or a hearing to provide their status. She was simply not happy with the information she was getting from them, and has made quite clear she thinks the government is in fact stonewalling in this case.
The case obviously that's been grabbing the most attention is that of Kilmar Abrego Garcia. That's the Maryland man who was deported in what's been described as an administrative error. But are there other cases where the judges are accusing the administration of deliberately delaying or stonewalling court orders?
Well, absolutely. And again, there is some subjectivity here, and the coin of the realm is good faith. And that's the legal language. Does the judge feel, or do the judges feel, that both parties are acting in good faith in their attempts to comply with the law? Just this week, another judge in the District of Maryland found that another individual who had been removed to Maryland, from the country to El Salvador, that the government was playing fast and loose with discovery rules and not providing information or answering in a timely manner. This was a judge, and I hate saying this, but appointed by Donald Trump. I hate pointing out the president that appointed a judge, because it shouldn't be relevant, but to an extent it is. Once again, criticizing the administration's compliance with court orders and speed and candor. And so it keeps happening in a number of these cases.
So there seems to be a pattern here. So is there a strategy driving this, a legal strategy?
There could be. Now, I want to be clear. Attorneys are free and should zealously advocate on behalf of their clients and even sometimes test the bounds of what the law will allow them to do. That is advocacy, and that is an important aspect of making sure that all sides are heard appropriately in court. The problem is where discovery, the area in which parties give information to the other side is used as a tool for depriving the other side of information that they're entitled to. And that seems to be happening here. So the government is taking advantage of a clear ambiguity in the law. Not a bad one, but just the reality that they have a little bit of wiggle room, but really going quite far in playing fast and loose with what they're obligated to provide to their opponents.
So if the administration really is evading compliance, who decides that, and how could it be held accountable?
Certainly, it is the judge. It's absolutely the judge's determination. Now, the judge can hold a party in contempt if there are orders from the court that the party defies, and that the judge finds that the party's defied those orders willingly or voluntarily. But it's really her or his decision to do so. Through they find facts and they call the parties in, and figure out should a civil or even criminal contempt order happen. Most of the time, when a judge threatens contempt, the parties all come to the table and provide the court at least something that it's looking for. But again, the judge needs to find that they are acting in good faith and at least trying to comply with what the judge is asking of them.
All right, finally, and I'm thinking we might have to return to this question, but a number of commentators, and I have to say legal scholars of different ideological perspectives, who have been warning that we are approaching a constitutional showdown or crisis between the judiciary and the executive branches, or that we are already in one. And do you have an opinion about that? Do you think that's true?
I have a very strong opinion about that. I do not believe we're in one right now, only because a crisis assumes that the existing order is not sufficient to solve the problem. There are still courts that can rule, and as of right now, the government is at least nominally complying with the courts. If there comes a day in which the government, the president, whomever else decides not to follow a court order, then of course we are in a constitutional crisis. As of today, what is it, April 25th, 2025, we're not there yet, but it could be coming.
That's Elliot Williams. He's a former Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Justice Department during the Obama administration. He's also a CNN analyst. Elliot Williams, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Great talking to you, Michelle.
The housing market was expected to rebound this spring after two very slow years. But as NPR's Laurel Wamsley reports, many Americans are stuck right where they are due to high mortgage rates and high prices.
Existing home sales dropped in March, nearly 6% lower than in February, seasonally adjusted. That's the largest month-over-month decline in nearly 2.5 years.
I think that reflects the high mortgage rates that we saw at the start of the year, particularly in January and February.
That's Charlie Dougherty, senior economist at Wells Fargo. It takes a couple months to buy a home most of the time, so those rates around 7% in January meant sluggish sales in March. And that's a bad omen for the housing market, because March is the beginning of what's supposed to be the busy spring season. That's when families are shopping, so they can move when school is out. Yet, despite these sluggish sales,
you're still seeing home prices go up, maybe at a slower rate, but still at a pace that is making affordability challenging for a lot of buyers.
One of those would-be buyers is 35-year-old Nora Scullin.
I do find it discouraging.
She lives with her husband and 4-year-old daughter in an apartment in Seattle. The rent for their 2-bedroom isn't cheap. They pay $3,200 a month. But they found it's a lot less than what a similar place would cost to buy when they tried shopping for a home in January and February.
We mostly just found that places that are not like studio or 1-bedroom are pretty much, at least where we live, exclusively over $1 million.
And after dipping slightly last month, mortgage rates are back up. They're about 6.8%, rising as President Trump's tariff threats have created uncertainty and roiled the bond markets that influence rates. But even if mortgage rates did drop, Scullin says that probably wouldn't help them buy a place in Seattle, since it would just bring out more buyers.
So for now, we just continued renting because it's going to cost more to own something.
That's a common calculation these days, in a country where home ownership remains out of reach for so many. And on the other side, with for sale signs out front, are sellers hoping that a buyer for their home will still come through. Laurel Wamsley, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
thing I remember knowing.
On the next Fresh Air, Country Music Hall of Famer Merle Haggard talks about hopping freight trains, doing prison time, and becoming a musician. He was fascinated by trains as a boy. Later, when he was a star, he acquired his own observation car. That car is now part of Virginia's Scenic Railway. Join us.
One and only rebel child from a family meek and mild. My mama seemed to know what lay in store.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday. Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Before Tina Knowles became known as the behind-the-scenes force helping to style and guide Beyoncé and Solange, she owned a beauty shop, she liked to cook and care for her family and friends, and she prided herself on helping other people achieve their dreams. Now, in a new book, Tina Knowles steps into the spotlight herself with the inside story of how she helped her girls achieve rare heights of stardom. The book is called Matriarch. I spoke with her recently. I was at our studios in Washington, D.C., and Tina Knowles was in a studio in Los Angeles. Welcome. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
May I call you Miss Tina?
Of course.
I was struggling with how to describe your book. It tells the story of Black entrepreneurship, how you and your former husband, Matthew Knowles, built your business. And it's also the story of mothers, being a mother, the mothers we had, the ones we wished we had. It's a lot. And I was wondering, when you started writing this book, is that what you started with, or did it just become that?
You know, I actually was going to write a book about behind the scenes things with my career in the music business, but it just came out of me. Once I started writing, it was like I just wanted to tell my story.
One of the things that I got from the book was how hard you had to fight to allow the girls to express their style. There was a magazine cover shoot where they wanted to put Beyoncé's hair in a bun. And you were like, they're not going to put your hair in a bun. Why does her hair have to be in a bun? And also, Maxwell was in that same cover shoot, and you talked about the fact that this was at a point where, if people know Maxwell, he had this crown of hair that was kind of his signature, but they wanted him to put on a hat. And you were like, don't let them make you put on a hat. You took his hat off and were picking out his hair.
Right. I took his hat off. I didn't even know him, but he looked sad. And so I walked over and I said, why do you look so sad? And he said, oh, they made me put this hat on. And I took it off, and I took my pick and started picking his hair out. And Beyoncé was mortified. She was like, Mom, what are you doing? But Maxwell and I connected that day, and we are really good friends. And, you know, he tells that story all the time, because why did they want Beyoncé to put her hair in a bun and for him to put a hat on? I didn't like that.
This happened like over and over again. And in fact, one of the music companies that you talked to actually talked to your ex, Matthew Knowles, who was their manager, and actually said that you were holding the girls back.
Well, they were just doing what they knew. And they felt like four Black girls, curvy country Black girls from Texas, with big hair and very Motown-esque costumes were not... They were right, and that wasn't the style then. There were all these pop icons with huge careers, and they felt like they should look like them, and they should wear jeans and midriff tops, and they were like, this is so Motown, it's so over the top. But we liked over the top. We were from Texas. They looked different. And I think that was refreshing to the audience, because in the meantime, people were coming up to us all the time saying, we can't wait to see what you guys are going to have on next. And some of it looked a little crazy. I mean, I look at it like, now we look at it now, we were like, what were we thinking? But it was that time.
Well, how did you get the chutzpah? This is not a Texas word. I'm from New York, so I'm going to say it. The chutzpah to say to these people, this is what they want to wear.
I'll tell you, I was a sort of laid back, behind the scenes person, a little, I wouldn't say shy, but when it came to my girls, I was a beast, like most mothers are. You know, the mother bear comes out. And I would bring out badass Teeny B.
Who's badass Teeny B?
And I would stand up to people.
Who is badass Teeny B?
Badass Teeny B was this little girl who had to protect herself from the nuns and from the message that I wasn't enough and I didn't belong and I had to fight. So I didn't have any problems saying this is who they are, this is what they like. And people would be like, oh God, who is somebody's mama coming in here trying to tell me my job? But I fought for it. I fought with people and I'm really proud of that.
You write a lot about your relationship with your ex in the book. Mm-hmm. It's moving and it's deep and it had to have been hard to write about, very on and off and on and off.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say for people who haven't had a chance to read the book yet, you don't let yourself off the hook. You talk about the ways in which you kind of participated in this.
Well, it takes two people to be in a relationship. And I just, for so many reasons, stayed in this relationship for way longer than I should have. But he was the first person in my life to really say, I won't say the first, but the second person that told me I could do anything and always said, oh, you got this. You can do this. He was always my biggest cheerleader. And that's hard to give up.
Did your daughters get input or a read in the book? Did they get
an
edit?
They haven't read the book.
They haven't read it.
They only read their parts.
Interesting.
The parts that they're involved in. They are kind of busy.
So how do you feel now that you've put your story out, that you've got it down on paper and it's out there for the world?
It's kind of scary. It's kind of scary. I tell you, sometimes I wake up and I'm like, did I just really do that? You know, it's a big deal because you're opening yourself up. But it's important to me to tell my own story, especially in my family, because there's been so many narratives and so much speculation. And I just think everyone should write their story for their kids and their grandkids and their great, great, great grandchildren. I wish I would have had that from my mother.
That's Teena Knowles. Her new book is called Matriarch, and it's out now. This is NPR News.
Improved climate modeling helped forecast the intensity of hurricanes Milton and Helene last year. Now scientists worry that big cuts to weather research may affect the ability to forecast future severe weather events.
If the siren doesn't go off, then you're going to be caught unawares.
I'm Ari Shapiro. The impact of the administration's cuts to climate research on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. World leaders, including President Trump, are on their way to Rome for Pope Francis's funeral tomorrow. Trump, who'd visited with Francis twice, remembered the pontiff fondly today. As the president prepared to depart the White House, he told reporters U.S. and Russia talks are underway about ending the war in Ukraine.
We're meeting with Putin right now as we speak.
and we have a lot of things going on, and I think in the end we're going to end up with a lot of good deals, including tariff deals and trade deals. We're going to make our country rich, but we're going to try and get out of war so that we can save 5,000 people a week, and that's what my aim is. I want to save 5,000 young men.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has long maintained, though, that Russian leader Vladimir Putin must be held to account in order for a peace deal to work. Today, the country is observing a day of mourning, a day after Russian airstrikes on Kyiv killed at least 12 people. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports.
Zelensky says his country wants peace. He has agreed to an unconditional 30-day ceasefire brokered by the U.S. last month, something Russia did not agree to. And Zelensky's team is finalizing a minerals deal that could make the U.S. a lot of money. So in return, Ukraine wants the U.S. to provide security guarantees so Russia does not invade their country again. But the Trump administration so far is only offering vague promises.
NPR's Joanna Kakissis reporting. From Washington, this is NPR News. The world-renowned Juilliard School in New York says it is on a mission to eliminate tuition for all of its performing arts programs. Jeff London reports a private conservatory has announced a $550 million fundraising campaign.
Tuition at the Juilliard School, which offers curricula in music, dance, and drama, costs approximately $55,000 a year. The fundraising initiative, which already has pledges of $180 million, aims to bring tuition for all students to zero. Several programs at Juilliard are already tuition-free, including the school's Preparatory Division for New York students from 8 to 17. In a statement, Juilliard President Damian Wetzel says, quote, "Financial barriers cannot be the determining factor in accessing Juilliard's transformative education." For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
The maker of Donkey Kong and Super Mario games has to contend with the ongoing trade war's impact on its latest major release. Online pre-orders of Nintendo Switch 2 console kicked off just after midnight Thursday, quickly sold out. It's a test of the Japanese video game company's ability to manage its supply chain and maintain Switch 2's nearly $450 price tag in the face of steep tariffs. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Juan Carlos Cruz was not always a friend of Pope Francis, but he became one. In his youth, Cruz survived abuse at the hands of a notorious Chilean priest. The Pope caused a scandal in 2018 when he defended clergy accused of letting that abuse happen. And then Pope Francis changed. He said he was wrong, apologized, and invited Cruz and other survivors to visit him and share their stories. And that marked the beginning of a close friendship.
he started calling me on the phone, and then I started visiting him every month, and then I moved to Spain, and I visited him every 2 weeks. And last Christmas, he invited me to spend it with him, and we spent all our birthdays together, his and mine. So it was a very beautiful friendship.
Cruz has served for years now on the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors, a Vatican commission that advises the Catholic Church on child sexual abuse. I asked him why he believed the Pope's mea culpa.
I had never felt an apology like his. You know, apologies just in words don't really matter, but he did things. He summoned all the Chilean bishops to Rome and told them to resign. That was a pretty important moment in the history of the church and the history of abuse, because Pope Francis did what no pope did before, which is call the abuse by its name, sexual abuse, abuse of power, abuse of conscience, cover up. Of course, he needs to do more, or he could have done more, but I think he left us on the right path, and hopefully the next pope follows through with what he started.
How have you been reflecting on your relationship with him?
I cannot believe that he died. To be honest, I get emotional thinking of this. Of course, he's the Pope. And as much as I saw him and I spent afternoons with him in his little living room outside his bedroom, and every time I saw him was a privilege and was like the first time. I never took it for granted. I reflect on him as a man who was in love with every human being and in love with life. And that's how I'm going to remember him, a man that cared deeply to tell everybody that they belonged, no matter where they came from and who they were.
When you think about Pope Francis when he was elected, and then Pope Francis in 2025, I mean, it sounds like, for you at least, there was a big difference in his understanding of sexual abuse in the church, like a radical change.
Absolutely, yeah. He was so poorly informed by the cardinals in Chile and cardinals throughout many countries. And when he had the courage to sit with victims, to hear victims, to believe them, to understand, he had a radical change. When he appointed me to the Pontifical Commission as his advisor, and he told me, please help me here, help me change this and eliminate the scourge of abuse from the church. And look, there's still a lot to do, but I'm proud of what he started and what he's done.
And what else would you like to see the commission do?
I would like the commission to continue its work. I would love the new pope to follow the line of Francis, someone who deeply cares about the horror of abuse and understands that there are still victims around the world begging for justice. Nobody in the church should be begging for justice. Until we fix that, we will not be able to move forward.
The Survivors Network of those abused by priests, known as SNAP, say it's a tragedy that the Pope died without doing more for survivors. Mm-hmm. How do you see it?
I see it. It's a tragedy that Pope Francis couldn't do more. You know, I see from inside and from outside, and survivors agree, other survivors don't agree. I stand up to cardinals, I stand up to bishops, even if they kick me out of the Vatican in the next papacy, I don't care. I'm going to continue doing it because it's horrific that abuse is still a thing in the church.
And Juan Carlos, could you share maybe your favorite memory of you and Pope Francis?
You know, I would love to tell you hours of laughter and of his incredible sense of humor, his, you know, sometimes dad jokes, but, you know, I'm Chilean and he's Argentina, so we have a lot of things in common.
And a rivalry, too, a natural rivalry.
And we played that rivalry, yeah. And he told me that I only watched soccer World Cups on TV while they won. And so it was like that. He was so witty and yet so wonderful to everybody. And look, I'm going to miss him.
That is Juan Carlos Cruz, a friend of Pope Francis, who serves on the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors. Juan Carlos, thank you very much for sharing.
Thank you.
Back here in the U.S., a U.S. Supreme Court decision guarantees all students the right to an education. There's an effort to end that federal right to education for undocumented students, but it has stalled. This year, Tennessee was one of a few Republican-led states that tried to challenge the ruling. Mariana Bacalhau of WPLN in Nashville tells us that Tennessee's efforts may not be law, but isn't entirely off the table.
The measure would have allowed K-12 schools to refuse students based on their legal status or else charge their families tuition. That goes against Plyler v. Doe, a 1982 U.S. Supreme Court decision. The bill's sponsor, Beau Watson, quoted from the dissenting opinion on the Senate floor.
Modern education, like medical care, is enormously expensive.
Republicans have been looking to overturn that decision, arguing that it's a burden on states to educate students without legal status. But those attempts haven't panned out. A Texas bill failed to advance, and in Oklahoma, the state superintendent's push for it was shot down by the governor. In Tennessee, the bill passed the Senate, but House leadership balked at the price tag. The measure could have jeopardized more than $1 billion in federal funding for violating the Civil Rights Act.
At some juncture, I just ran out of time.
That's the bill's House sponsor, William Lamberth. He sent a letter to the U.S. Secretary of Education one day before the legislative session ended, asking,
will this endanger $1.1 billion or more of federal funding or not? Under the Trump administration, I anticipate that the answer is going to be that it will not endanger any funds.
Lamberth didn't hear back before the end of session, so the bill is dead for now, something opponents are taking as a win, like immigrant advocate Lisa Sherman Luna, who helped organize protests against the bill.
Tennesseans showed up and sent a message loud and clear. Education is for all children, no matter where they're from or where they're born.
Meanwhile, this year, Illinois enshrined the right to a public education for students without legal status. But Tennessee's bill may not be dead for long. Depending on how talks with the federal government go, Lamberth has plans to bring the legislation back next year. For NPR News, I'm Mariana Bacalhau in Nashville.
This is NPR News.
Ziegler says the next reproductive rights battle will focus on whether fetuses and embryos have the rights of people under the Constitution. More next time, here and now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule, but with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them, in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. Researchers in Australia found some new fossils of prehistoric giant kangaroos. Normally, big animals have big habitats, but the new fossils show these guys pretty much stuck to their caves eating piles of leaves, just chilling at home when scientists said, relatable. But scientists also noted that being that homebound increased their risk of extinction when the climate changed. Yup, another nudge to get off the couch. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station
And from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. President Trump wants to change the way the White House handles government regulations. Keith Romer from our Planet Money podcast has a story about one of Trump's most recent executive orders.
Executive Order 14215 expands the power of a part of the executive branch you may have never even heard of, OIRA, the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs.
If you Google obscure but powerful government agency, OIRA probably will show up on the first page.
Susan Dudley ran OIRA under President George W. Bush. She told me one of OIRA's big jobs is to review, with a critical eye, proposed regulations from different federal agencies, like the Department of Transportation or the EPA or the FDA.
I joke that OIRA has to kind of wear the black hat and be the one to say, well, let's look at how this works. But it does mean that you're nobody's favorite person.
For decades, OIRA has given the White House a way to make sure that new regulations align with the president's agenda. But before this new executive order, there was one part of the government whose rules OIRA did not review, the independent regulatory agencies. Places like the Federal Trade Commission, Federal Communications Commission, and Securities and Exchange Commission. Corey Frere worked at the SEC in the Biden administration.
Being an independent agency means that although the leadership of the agency is appointed by the president, they are expected to act at an arm's length from the administration that appointed them.
Traditionally, independent agencies have had a lot of freedom. But Frere says presidents could still influence their policies.
The point of the independence of these agencies is not that a president isn't allowed to have an opinion, and not that a president isn't allowed to express that opinion. It is that they don't have a way to enforce that opinion.
For Frere, the expansion of OIRA's powers is worrying.
This is a terrible idea. When you outright state that your intention is to interfere in an agency's independent rulemaking process, that undermines the trust in the marketplace that makes the American financial markets the deepest and most liquid and most attractive in the world.
Susan Dudley sees things differently. In fact, in 2018, she co-wrote an op-ed with an OIRA administrator from the Clinton years, calling for a similar reform to the one in the executive order.
I think it's fair to say that former OIRA administrators from both sides of the aisle support having independent agencies be covered under the executive order.
Dudley is sympathetic to people like Corey Frere, who worry that the Trump administration is trying to consolidate too much power in the presidency. But to her, this move at least makes sense.
Well, this probably sounds Pollyannish, but I think it means that the independent regulatory agencies will do a more thorough analysis and their regulations will be better.
I reached out to the White House for this story and was connected with someone who was only willing to be identified as a senior administration official. This official told me, quote, "No agency is independent. It goes back to the Constitution. The President of the United States is the head of the executive branch." Keith Romer, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
This is NPR News.
We'll be right back.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And Mae Martinez. Tesla sales are falling dramatically. The company's revenue from cars dropped 20% in the first quarter compared to the same time last year. Tesla blames that on factors such as customers waiting for the new version of its Model Y. Industry analysts say it's also because of the way customers view CEO Elon Musk, especially his government-slashing actions leading the unit known as Doge. Now, that's prompted thousands of Tesla owners to slap stickers on their cars that read,
"I bought this before we knew Elon was crazy. The anti-Elon Tesla Club. Elon killed my resale value. Elon is a Doge bag."
That's Matt Hiller, founder of Mad Puffer Stickers. He's seen a spike in sales since making a range of anti-Elon slogans.
"I was interested in buying a Tesla. I like the tech. I like the fact that they were good for the environment. But this was around January 2023, and he had bought Twitter already. And he was sort of becoming a bully and sort of pushing disinformation. So it completely turned me off of the idea of buying a Tesla. So I figured I had this sticker store already, and I just knew there had to be so many people out there like me who just already had the Tesla and are just thinking like, wow, I mean, I got to distance myself from this."
Yeah. I mean, how many stickers about Elon Musk would you say that you've sold since you came up with the idea?
So it's looking like I'm closing in on about 70,000. That includes everything like magnets, vinyl cling stickers across all platforms, which is Amazon, Etsy, eBay, all the foreign Amazons, like European Amazon stores, and Redbubble.
Over the course of the last, say, year or so, have there been any particular moments when sales of the stickers spiked?
The very first one I can remember is where it went extra big was when he went on stage with Trump at a rally before the election. At that time, I believe I was getting maybe 50 sales a day, maybe 100. I can't even remember at this point, but it spiked so high. It was like in the hundreds after that. The next big day after that was after the election. But I would say by far, the moment that sort of ignited it to where it is now is in January when he did his salute. I think that just got a lot of people paying attention. And that's when I started hitting 500 sales a day.
I've seen, you know, the stickers all over the place, but I wanted to talk to a couple of people that have those stickers on their cars. So in the parking lot of my local grocery store, I just walked up to a couple of people and asked them why they bought the stickers. And they said a lot of the same things that you said, but they also said that they also didn't want their car to be damaged.
Oh, yes.
Because they've seen all of the videos and reports of vandalizing anything Tesla or Elon Musk related. Have you heard from people that also are worried that if they don't have a sticker like this, someone might be angry at them and mess up their car?
Yes. So occasionally I get people on my Etsy store, they buy a sticker as a gift, and then they get to write a little note along with the gift to the recipient. Occasionally I read the notes and I see one that says like, happy birthday from dad. This is to protect you on the mean streets of LA.
Wow.
I've heard anecdotally that some people who aren't necessarily against Elon would buy the sticker anyway, just as a form of protection on their car.
So how much money have you made off of all this?
I've made, into the six figures.
Wow.
It's kind of changed my life over the last few months, just trying to keep up with it.
I mean, how long do you think this will go on?
If it ended tomorrow, I'm totally fine. You know, I didn't set out to do this, and it's certainly not my business plan going forward. It's not a really good business plan to bank on a billionaire just annoying people forever, right?
That's Matt Hiller, creator of a bunch of anti-Elon Musk stickers for Tesla owners. Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And we just want to note that we reached out to Tesla to ask them about the Mad Puffer stickers. They have yet to respond.
April is National Poetry Month. It's also calving season. You know, when cows give birth to their babies. Apparently someone here has an unfulfilled yearning for ranch life. No shade. But because of that, we're going to spotlight poetry that focuses on wide open spaces.
That's right, cowboy poetry.
I call it a celebration of the history of the West, both past and present.
Yvonne Hollenbeck is known as a cowgirl poet. Unlike us, she lives on a ranch in South Dakota. And in 50 years of ranch life, she's found inspiration in its daily rhythms.
He can see if a windmill is working or not from his horse on a faraway hill and see which direction the wind's coming from by watching the tail on the mill. He's got eyes like an eagle for spotting new calves that the mamas have hidden all snug. So why can't he see the mud on his boots that he's tracking all over my rug?
Good question. Hollenbeck's old eagle eye gives us a sense of two trademarks of cowboy poetry, rhyme and punchline.
J.B. Barber is another poet who salutes life in the saddle. He's president of the Cowboy Poets of Idaho.
I was a rodeo cowboy. I did rough stock riding and got too old and too banged up. I became a roper, team roper. And then when I got too more banged up, I just laid down my rope and saddle and picked up my guitar. And I started doing cowboy poetry in the 90s.
Sung or spoken, Barber says cowboy poetry is something like sharing tales around the campfire. His poem, The Big Sale, takes us to a horse auction.
The auctioneer's face turned beet red. Steam mist coming out of both ears. And he started in a screaming. Cowboy, a horse hadn't sold for that much around here in years. But that crazy owner walked into the sale ring where his horse stood. He looked up at that auctioneer and said, but I didn't know I owned a horse this good.
And if you've been with us for a while, I hope you remember a late friend of this program's, Baxter Black.
Baxter gave his poetry to Morning Edition for 20 years, and he could find fun in everything from feedlots to horseshoes to cow socks.
Cows have an IQ somewhere between a cedar post and a sandhill crane. However, fate has made the cow and cowboy dependent on each other. This same unnatural relationship that exists between politicians and reporters, or lawyers and criminals.
As his family put it, Baxter rode his old horse home in 2022. His last poem in cowboy poet fashion notes that heaven for a cowboy is just what you might expect, with horses that need tuning up and heifers that need to be checked.
Do they have bodegas out in L.A.?
Nah, we just call them liquor stores.
Okay. Okay, but what about bodega cats?
I'm sure some cats must live there. Right.
I'm trying to act like you don't know. Okay. Well, there are whole websites devoted to New York City's bodega cats. This afternoon on All Things Considered, you can hear more about the online fandom surrounding these famous felines. Listen on your radio, in the app, or your smart speaker. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And Amy Martinez.
Ladies and gentlemen, wee hours with Eric Clapton. Man of the Blues.